Welcome to another episode of Chats in Linguistic Diversity. My name is Ingrid Piller, and I'm Distinguished Professor of Applied Linguistics at Macquarie University. My guest today is Professor Adam Jaworski from the University of Hong Kong. Welcome to the show, Adam.
Thank you so much, Ingrid. It's really great to be here and a pleasure. Thank you.
Adam, can you start us off by telling our listeners a bit about yourself, your career trajectory and your research?
Sure. Thank you. I started in Poland at the University of Adam Mickiewicz in Poznań. I was an undergraduate in English philology, doing a little bit of language and literature, culture, sort of area studies. And after all the sort of introductory courses in phonetics, grammar, including Chomsky's syntax, which was not really something that I enjoyed very much. I came across sociolinguistics. I took a course of sort of basic concepts, and eventually, when I was a postgraduate student and I went on to non-degree kind of fellowships in the United States. I did some more work around methods in sociolinguistics, and that sort of set me up, and I started exploring different topics. Maybe too many in some ways, because I've never really developed one major area of expertise. My PhD was in the area of sexist language in Polish and English, looking at the relationship between grammatical gender and biological sex, male language bias in language, gender stereotyping, representation of gender in and gender roles in textbooks. So I probably thought that was a good topic for sort of writing and researching of political aspects of language and society back in the communist times in Poland. I think it was in the early 1980s, and I suppose that Poland was not quite ready for kind of radical work on language and gender at the time. I was very pleased to see that this was picked up later by other scholars after I had left Poland. But that was my start. Then I looked at some aspects of ethnographically related work on the pragmatics of speech acts, apologies, compliments, greetings, and other forms of formulaic language. So that was partly inspired by my sense of some pedagogical duty, and especially in the case of educating students, Polish students, about the sort of pragmatics of English speech acts. And then I chose to write my postdoctoral piece or as what we would call habilitation back in Poland or in Germany, I decided to write about silence as a trope of communication in language and other modalities, and that stayed with me for quite some time when I explored it in other contexts. And just to finish off this overly long list, you know, I've been doing some work, sort of traditional CDA type of work in media, language, and political discourse. I've done some work in the framework of interactional sociolinguistics on friendship groups, mostly about looking at the kind of chit-chat among undergraduate students in timeout talk. And the a major part of my work, mostly in collaboration with Crispin Thurlow, was about language and tourism. So that's been kind of
And that's what I want to talk with you about. So you know, we wanted to talk about language on the move, actually, but specifically your research is sort of in language and mobility, and that's obviously a research interest we both share. One thing you've already mentioned, tourism, and one thing that's really quite unique about your research in this space now, language and mobility is a very popular research topic at the moment, or has been for probably a decade now. Your research stands out with its focus on elite mobilities, tourism, as you say. And so I was wondering whether you could talk us through your approach to language and mobility, mobility as consumption, and your focus on elites.
Yes, thank you. I suppose that I kind of fell into the topic of tourism at some point, just because I didn't, there was probably not so much work in sociolinguistics or discourse analysis in that area. And I then discovered that there was a huge amount of work on tourism in other areas such as sociology and anthropology, and an area of study or discipline called tourism or tourism studies or critical discourse or tourism studies, on also geography, which was a very important aspect of what I drew on at the time. Crispin and I have tried to find a way to talk about tourism in the context of sociolinguistics. And it is true that we probably stumbled on this idea of looking at elite mobility, partly because sociolinguistics at the time, and to some extent today, had always concentrated on social groups and individuals who had been one way or another marginalized or disenfranchised or oppressed, all for good reason. But I think at some point we found a quote from Mary Douglas that we used as an epigram in one of the our papers, which resonated with us greatly. And you know, it went something like, unless we know why people need luxuries and how they use them, we are nowhere near taking the problem of inequality seriously. And so I'm sort of mentioning here luxury as a kind of as a lens which we have also used to talk about sort of high-end mobility and tourism, because the consumption of these tourist contexts is steeped in consumption of luxury goods and vast amounts of service provided by relatively low paid workers, and service as and this is also something that you have looked at in your work, the idea of emotional labor and providing service as a manifestation of status and class. So so there was a whole raft of issues. Some of it were concentrated on more linguistic kind of questions in terms of what is it that tourists and locals talk about? Do they actually talk about anything? And I suppose that what I realized early on was that the register of talk in tourism is very specific. It's very limited in some ways, but follows very rigid patterns of formulaic, scripted, high performance frame exchanges. Most of the as we found it, most exchanges are led by commodified kind of exchanges, service encounters. So I think we kind of identified a number of genres which in some ways sprang out as a kind of discursive and semiotic industry around global mobility and tourism to service the class of tourists in their consumption of places and people. And so the analysis of these genres was part of what we started to analyze.
And I think, I mean, that's probably one of the really fascinating aspects of your research and the innovative aspect, all those genres. There is often this, I guess, facile assumption that English is the language of globalization and English is the premier language of mobility. And there certainly is a lot of English in your data, but at the same time, it's a special kind of English, and you've really trained our attention to genres and away from code towards bits and pieces of text and bits and pieces of linguistic objects. And I'm just curious, maybe you could actually tell us a bit more about concrete examples of what you mean when you talk about genres and the kinds of objects or linguistic objects on the move that you've looked at in your research.
Yeah, that's great. Yes, I think what we have come to look at and analyze was what we came to call, and this term became used by other researchers in different contexts, but we thought about this as a linguascape of tourism, and that was something that you and I also wrote about in the context of how Switzerland is linguascaped in the media in terms of displays and representations and meta discourses of different languages and multilingualism in the country. So a lot of tourist texts in travelogues and newspaper stories talk about Romansh as exotic linguascape, about other major languages in Switzerland as dominant multilingualism, and then English provides what we called safe linguascape. Destinations, countries are characterized by different ideologies of languages and multilingualism, which play out in different ways depending on the location. But we have not really used the term multilingualism as our entry point in our research, which may be surprising to you and your listeners. But it is true that we mostly concentrated on genres, styles, and discourses through English, but there was a need from time to time to actually we were not able to ignore multilingualism, but multilingualism manifested itself in very interesting specific ways. For example, when we realized that mostly monolingual tourists, English monolingual tourists, will use local languages to consume places and local people, for example, through the act of code crossing. And there would be a lot of symbolic play or consuming languages as if they were part of the local culture offered on display and for consumption of tourists, pretty much like if you go to Mexico and you buy a sombrero that you're wearing at night for a fiesta or something like this, or when women have their hair braided in the Gambia. So these moments of clothes, accessories, or linguistic snippets are consumed by tourists as part of their embodied performances of otherness or exoticism. And so we were quite interested in emphasizing or discovering the linguistic aspects of tourism, partly because other tourist scholars considered language as a very marginal semiotic resource in tourism. And I think by mobilizing some of the sociolinguistic approaches and theory into that area of social life, hopefully we were able to talk about some other ways of how tourism is structured around the world. So other examples of linguistic manifestation of tourist performances can be identified in the way places, destinations are spatialized with language, for example, by specific tourist signs, such as welcome signs, okay, which perform a very important ubiquitous, you could say, function of welcoming tourists to a destination, repeating that speech act almost throughout the whole time of someone's visit, using local and also world languages in order to style these destinations by displaying place names in the local languages, but also displaying internationalism or cosmopolitanism of these places by using bilingual displays of the greeting itself or the phrase welcome. But there is also a lot of interesting work that we got to realize that these multimodal signs pay attention to the way fonts can style places. Multimodal imagery is added to the place names in the form of emblematic images of place. Materiality of these signs signals to visitors whether the destination or attraction is meant to be upmarket or expensive, posh, or whether it's affordable and egalitarian. So there is a lot of information that you can glean from fairly mundane and ubiquitous kind of language objects, as I would like to call them.
And in many ways, I think that has made your research so fascinating, that you've actually been able to pick precisely those mundane objects or linguistic objects that many people would overlook, you know, just another welcome sign or just another you are now in blah-de-blah sign. And so that's really been quite fascinating about your research. And another area where you've also picked something that is incredibly mundane and turned it into a number of really insightful observations and analyses or interpretations related to language and mobility is something that you've called globalese. And I was wondering whether you could tell our listeners what you mean by globalese and how that relates both to some of the concepts you've just mentioned, like tourism, cosmopolitanism, commodification.
Yeah, thank you. Yes, I think that this work comes from my fascination with the visuality of language. And so I think quite gradually I have shifted my attention from speech to writing. And displayed language or semiotics. And I must say it is one of my kind of favorite pastimes is walking around cities and taking photographs of signs or all kinds of different semiotic displays, and not always knowing exactly why I'm taking pictures, but at some point I realized that I had quite a collection of photographs of signs or logos or slogans or other type of objects, which made use of what I felt were unusual uses of punctuation, also diacritics or foreign foreign letters, numbers, mathematical symbols, and forms like that. And I realized that many different languages, when they are used for mostly commercial and cultural kind of reasons in displayed in displays of commercial or cultural contexts, they draw on ethno-national languages in a way that seems to be aiming to adapt them and index ideologies which shift away from ethno-national ones. So maybe if brands or products or groups of people want to be seen as cosmopolitan, or when they want to express the idea that they are part of a world to be conceived as a single place, or globalization or transnationalism, they will. Well, let me say use the word play with familiar forms of writing in a way that will exoticize them, that will convey the idea of globalization, and I think that there are degrees of uniformity in these stylized uses of language, which always build on local languages, and depend on signifiers of what target audiences understand or are likely to interpret as foreign, exotic, or global.
Yeah, and I guess that brings us to another question. Like, I mean, many of these commercial signs, the brand names, as you say, that's sort of mixed languages, or it's not even a mixing, as you point out, but sort of index another space, another linguistic realm, or another ethno-national realm. These indexes are quite artful in many ways. And another of your interests relates to language and art. So let's maybe transition to language and art by letting me ask you all those signs that we see in the malls and that you call globalies, are they art?
Yes, well, that's a wonderful question, I must say, partly because it is true that language and art is the area that is closest to my heart at the moment. It has always been there, but I think other projects, topics, and collaborations have distracted me a little bit from doing work in this area. But yeah, I must say I'm quite drawn to these types of data, which I call language objects, which are written multimodal and uses and displays of language, which are mostly produced for symbolic or decorative purposes, also artistic. So these are the kinds of uses of language that and functions that Roman Jakobson would call that they fulfill the poetic function. Yeah. And that goes back in time quite a lot when you think about the sort of 16th century cross-stitched samplers in Europe. And there were earlier examples in other parts of the world. Let me just stick to Europe for the time being. So so these were sort of vernacular grassroots practices which depended on cross-stitching to make alphabetic, floral, or biblical scenes, also non-representational or abstract kind of images made with letters, and they were used to for home decoration. When you think about the past, okay, we are so used to living with images, but back in the 16th century and later, you know, images were very rare. They were a prerogative of rich people, and images were to be found in churches where people worshipped, and in the context of these sort of spectacles of religious imagery, for example. But anyway, so cross-stitched samplers were an early form of what I'm interested in. Today, we find lots and lots of popular cultural artifacts which come from this tradition. As you probably know, one of my case studies is the work by the American pop artist Robert Indiana and his famous, we could say, iconic image of the word love with the slightly slanted O. There are many other objects which use words as the primary material. It's not just love, although love is probably most ubiquitous in commerce and popular culture, but also words like peace, dream, relax. You can buy a lot of these objects in all kind of novelty shops to display on your mantelpiece or on the wall of your living room, but also blessings and prayers, which were more common in the past, probably, or were the dominant ones in the past. All kinds of fridge magnets, which include fridge poetry, or other kind of phrases like "Don't worry, be happy." All kinds of motivational quotes that people display on t-shirts and other clothes that they, or accessories that they wear. So yes, I think a lot of popular culture today is so linguistic and visually linguistic. And I think it does go back to art and design. My main point of reference is the beginning of modern art in Europe. There's surely a huge tradition of writing calligraphy in other cultures. The tradition of literati paintings in China. There is Arabic and Persian calligraphy. I'm afraid I don't know the relevant languages and so much about them to be knowledgeable about them and to write about them. But there are very fascinating examples of contemporary art from China, Iran, and also obviously Europe, which go back to some of these traditions, and I can sort of make sense of them enough for me to actually look at the text-based art in terms of the creativity, materiality, and also language ideologies which underpin the experiments and the creativity of text-based artists. So I think there are some interesting lessons for us as sociolinguists to draw from the way artists have used language, so that we maybe can explore it as a material and symbolic resource in what, let's call it, in everyday life. But there is a lot of long-term activism in conceptual art, which now also, well, activism is becoming a very important aspect of sociolinguistic work. And I think there are some parallels to be drawn by looking at the tradition of using language and text and writing in art and social life, as theorized by sociolinguists. So this is currently mostly what I'm interested in, and I can talk about this a bit more, but I'm not sure. I don't want to hog the floor.
Well, let me give you an example that I'm quite curious about. You've been part of your work has been or your work has been part of the multimodality movement and linguistics, that linguistics has really gone beyond the logocentrism, if you will, of earlier times, and we are now interested in how language is emplaced in the world, visual aspects of language, and the whole multimodality movement. At the same time, some of the things that you've been talking about in language art and in commodified language art really seem to be going the other way. And I'm particularly thinking of an example I saw recently. It's now January. Christmas is not so long in the past. And in one of the malls that I visited just before Christmas, there was a huge Christmas tree, except the Christmas tree was not a tree. It wasn't even an imitation of a tree, but it was actually the parts of the tree, if you will, the stems and everything. It was made out of words. And the words were precisely those words that you mentioned earlier, love, peace, joy. And it seems like we're coming full circle, and in art, or in the commodification of certain arts, actually going back to a logocentrism and making the word central and taking away all those other symbolic meanings that the Christmas tree used to have. And so, what's your take on that? A secular population, Australia, where actually it's summer when there is Christmas, and so no need to bring in trees into the home.
That's right. Yeah, I think that's a very pertinent observation. I think there is a, to use a probably a rather tired and maybe not useful expression. In some ways, there is a linguistic turn in commerce, art, and culture. But what I mean by this specifically is that indeed language, or writing to be more specific, it has been used extensively in the past two or three decades, if not earlier, but probably the last 30 years or so, as a very important metonymic resource for of representation and stylization of space and human activities more broadly. And I think that that goes back to the economic changes related to globalization. There's no way we cannot mention Monica Heller's work in this context, who I think was the first one to draw sociolinguists' attention to the changes, cultural changes and linguistic changes affected by the shift of advanced economies from manufacturing to what we may want to call information economy, where language became the object and the product and the medium of work. And I think that a lot of developments in art predated these shifts. I think artists realized the potential of language in the symbolic and material value of language before marketers and big business and companies. I think what we see today is to a great extent the experiments with language from cubism, futurism, Dada, and all the avant-garde European and North American up until about 1950s. Then there was the explosion of conceptual art, and the middle of the 20th century was probably a pivotal period for conceptual art to take hold and to develop globally, because it was not just Europe and North America. There's Japan, South Korea, Latin America, Eastern Europe, all kinds of places were experimenting with language, performance happening, all kinds of process-based art, I think a lot of roots in popular culture and the ubiquity of the visuality of language around us comes from that period. And I think that is something that I would like to probably explore a bit more, partly as a kind of as a way of historicizing what we are dealing with today in what we could call the semiotic landscape of our cities, and but also to say something about maybe some of the semiotic aspects of the use of language in the case of emplacement, materiality, and different stances that we are capable relating through the visuality of language in public spaces.
Yeah, I think that's actually a wonderful closing word to point out how deeply embedded language and linguistic research is in the social, and that we can't actually understand one without the other, and that is our continued effort and mission. Thank you so much for your time, Adam. It's been wonderfully informative conversation. Before I let you go, what's next for you in terms of your research and trajectory?
Thank you so much for that. And yes, I think the current and future work is very much related to the topics that we have just talked about a moment ago. So it is related to language and art, or text-based art, visuality of language in language objects. But the specific lens that I think I want to employ in theorizing these issues is the term spectacle or spectacular language. And I think this is a kind of a shift away from maybe a lot of research in sociolinguistics and related disciplines which have considered maybe the centrality of narrative or in language or narratives and stories, but I think there may be some space for theorizing spectacle as a kind of as a break from the narrative, and so that's probably the working title of my current project, as I would like to think of it, is Spectacular Language. I think
that's... Well, I can't wait to see that, so or read it. Good luck with it, and next time we'll talk about Spectacular Language.
Thank you, Ingrid.
Thank you so much, Adam. Thank you.